Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Dr. Patricia McConnell. Patricia is a certified applied animal behaviorist emeritus who has made a lifelong commitment to improving the relationship between people and animals. She is known worldwide as an expert on canine and feline behavior and dog training, and for her engaging and knowledgeable dog training books, DVDs, and seminars. Patricia has seen clients for serious behavioral problems since 1988 and taught the biology and philosophy of human/animal relationships at the University of Wisconsin for 25 years. A highly sought-after speaker on dog behavior and training, McConnell has presented seminars all over the United States and in Canada, Germany, Australia, Sweden, Belgium, Scotland, and right here in New Zealand. She is the author of the much acclaimed books, The Other End of the Leash, which is now published in 13 languages. For the Love of a Dog, Understanding Emotions in You and Your Best Friend, and her memoir about trauma in people and dogs, The Education of Will. Patricia and her husband Jim have two dogs, one confident cat, and a very spoiled flock of sheep on a small farm in southwestern Wisconsin. Her border collie Maggie, along with Cavalier King Charles Spaniel Tootsie, keep her outside and active, and the love for her beloved border collie Willie will never die. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Patricia to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Patricia, it's an absolute honor to have you on our podcast. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm very happy to be here. It's an honor. Myself, I love speaking to people in New Zealand, one of my absolute favorite countries of the world.
So much so that your Facebook profile has you on the Milford track.
That's right. That's right. I'm not making this up. I've had wonderful time in New Zealand.
When I found you on Facebook, I thought, oh, this must be the wrong person. I found some. Facebook is just showing me some local New Zealander called Patricia McConnell. But no, it was you, which is wonderful. And wonderful is a word that I'm sure we will use to describe this podcast today. I'm excited. Let's dive straight into the first question. Patricia, could you please take everyone listening back to where your personal behavior odyssey, as we like to call it here at ATA, started? How did you first get into working with animal behavior?
You know, whenever I'm asked that question, I go right back to one of my first memories of my entire life, which is when I was 5 years old. And I just made that discovery that other people have whole lives inside their own brains, you know, that it wasn't just sort of me as the center of the universe. And I generalized that to my dog, Fudge, this little terrier cross, as our family dog. And I lay on the living room floor and thought, well, what is going on in her brain? You know, what is she thinking about? What is life like for her? And I didn't really realize that I've been trying to answer that question for 65 years now. Now, I'll never forget that was my first strongest memory. The other thing that drove a lot of what I do now, Ryan, is when I was in elementary school, I had this great teacher. I was in sixth grade. I don't know what you call it, but I was about 12-ish or so. And I had this great teacher, and she had all of us, our homework was in English, was to write a story, just fiction, just write little one-page stories. And I loved doing it. And we would read them to the class. And eventually the class started asking to have mine read because they love my stories. And I dropped that for a couple of decades. But, you know, both of those things really were sort of the beginning of me loving to understand other species and to communicate with them and to write about it.
So for 65 years, you've been inspired by fudge.
Yeah, exactly.
So what, when you look at a dog now, yeah, or an animal or another human,
yeah,
do you still have that five-year-old fascination?
Oh, I do.
What's filling your mind now? Are you like, I know what you're thinking?
Oh, I totally do. Sometimes I think I know, you know, what another individual's thinking. And obviously, sometimes I don't. You know, we all get easily caught up in making assumptions. I think dog owners, dog lovers everywhere can get sucked into that, and sometimes not to the advantage of our dogs. But you know, the field that I studied in college, Ryan, ethology, a lot of the focus of ethology is on communication. And so I've really spent a lot of my professional life trying to figure out, what about an animal's expression or movement or posture or behavior or vocal communication? What can that tell us about what is going on in its mind? And what, perhaps even more importantly or as importantly, what is that telling us about the animal's future behavior? You know, so I do, I just find it all fascinating. I mean, just our language itself is so incredibly... Oh, I mean, I'm trying to use language to explain this phenomenon, this amazing phenomena that we have that is so great in one sense. It has so much nuance in it, and we can explain so much, and yet it's so flawed. I mean, we can miscommunicate with each other so amazingly easily. Every human on earth knows that they've misconstrued or been misunderstood countless times by even people they're very close to. So I find our own species to be very confusing sometimes, but absolutely fascinating. And I feel the same way about dogs, but you know, those are my two favorite species, but it's not just dogs. I love horses. I love cats. I love sheep. I love butterflies. I love birds. I am not a big fan of mosquitoes and wasps, but I try to be a good zoologist.
So from the age of 12, you've obviously grown up and you've decided on a course of study at university, which is ethology. Was that an easy decision for you to go? And additionally, before you answer that, the listeners of the show, they might not really even know a definition of ethology. They might not quite understand exactly what that means. So maybe I'd love to hear like why you decided that specific line of study, and also if you could define that for us.
Sure, yeah. Ethology, I was interested in I've always been interested in behavior. And I was very lucky at the university. Dr. Jack Hailman and Dr. Jeff Bayless, who was my major professor, were specialists in animal behavior. And they were both trained in the traditional sort of European ethological framework, which is looking at behavior from the viewpoint of the animal's genetic predispositions and the effect of the environment on the animal. It was at the time it first started in the 40s and 50s in Europe, it was in contrast to the American psychological experiments in laboratories, which eliminated all confounding factors, right? And those fields there was a lot of conflict between those fields. It's like, my field is better. It's better to study an animal in a lab because there are no confounding factors. And ethology was, no, that's not the real animal. You can't understand an animal until you see it in its natural habitat and understand its genetic predisposition. Good news is that those sort of rivals, those fields have integrated and basically acknowledge that both perspectives are absolutely essential to really understanding behavior. But so ethology is about behavior. A lot of my focus was on communication.
And so you did, what was your, remind me, I know I've read it on your website, but your PhD was on...
The PhD was on the structure of sound, you know, the way a sound sounds, and its influence on the behavior of the animal who hears it. So the question that I was looking at is, does the type of a sound or the structure of a sound, without any learning involved, inherently affect the behavior of the receiver? So I actually looked at professional animal handlers who spoke, I think it was 19 different languages, and how, what kind of sounds they used to speed animals up, to slow them down, to basically signal them. And so the first, I sort of got into that because I was looking at border collies and how human shepherds, not German shepherds, human sheep herder shepherds, how they use sound to communicate to their working border collies, and discovered there were a lot of similarities with the whistles they used to speed animals, to speed their dogs up and to slow them down, which were the same as the signals I had learned. I used to work with horses a lot. And when I wanted a horse to move forward, I would go. And when you want a border collie to walk up, most handlers do short, rapidly repeated whistles. So I ended up doing my PhD to see if that was truly universal across lots of different language groups, and whether in the laboratory, I looked at whether those sounds really do inherently have an effect on the animals. And indeed, what I found was very supportive, that short, rapidly repeated notes increase activity, whereas long, slow ones tend to soothe or calm it.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So was your PhD conducted pretty much immediately after your undergrad studies, or did you have a gap in there?
Yeah, I did have a gap. It was a wonderful gap. I worked for 2 years because I was broke, totally, completely broke. And I wasn't quite sure I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And I was very lucky. I got a job with Dr. Charles Snowden in the psychology department. He was working with cotton-topped tamarins, who are these Einsteinian-looking, adorable South American small primates, sort of squirrel size. And he was doing research on their vocal communication. And so I worked in that laboratory working with these lovely, lovely family groups in big, big family housed units, you know, real big cages. It was indoors, but they were very, very large, very tall, wide cages where they lived in family groups, and we studied their vocal communication. And then after 2 years of that, I decided, you know, I was working in primate behavior, right? And so sort of the next thing to do would be to go to Africa, you know, to go to the field and to study primates in South America or Africa somewhere. But I love being hands-on. And you can't touch, you know, you can't play with the monkeys, right? You can't affect their family structure and their family life. So I got really interested in this issue about communication between three different species, and sort of fell into studying the sounds that handlers give to their working border collies, and then that ended up turning into a PhD. So I went back to school after 2 years and started my PhD program.
And am I correct that the cotton-top tamarins have a huge array of different vocalizations they use?
Yes, they do. Very interesting. And they very interesting social dynamics. The females get pregnant while they're still nursing. They're young. So there's a tremendous amount of paternal care. The fathers actually carry the babies a lot. Huge energy load on the females. And so there's a lot of communication between them and their young, because their young have to live with them for quite a few years to learn how to carry their own, you know, other babies. So they help raise their sort of brothers and sisters from earlier generations. So there's a lot of very complicated vocal communication that goes on. It's a really fun system to study.
Awesome. And so when you finished your PhD, and thinking back to that time and where you thought your career and your line of work was going ahead, the vision you had, if you could think back to then of yourself in that age, this is a weird question, thinking forward to what you'd be doing now,
are you doing
what you thought you'd be doing?
No. When I went back to school, I mean, I knew it was a challenging field, you know, animal behavior. That's not exactly known as the way to riches, right? And sort of an easy path to find a job, right? So I knew it would be tricky. But what I envision is I just, you know, I worked at all these different jobs until I was basically 40. And I just decided I just wanted to make a living from something I was passionate about, just find a way to do that. So what I imagined is that I would get a job teaching animal behavior, zoology at some small college somewhere in the local area. I didn't want to move. So that's what I imagined. But then I going to Animal Behavior Society conferences, which is a great thing to do if you're interested in any kind of behaviors, including dog training, by the way. I ran into some people who were applied animal behaviorists, who took what they had learned about psychology, learning, biology, ethology, and were applying it to sort of real-life problems that people had either in zoological parks or with companion animal owners. And I thought, well, that's an interesting way to apply my knowledge, and I can get my hands all over the dogs who come into my office, and I get to work helping people. And I had been in social services working with troubled adolescents before. So, Ryan, it was like putting all these loves and past experiences together. So me and a partner, Dr. Nancy Raffetto, knowing nothing about business, opened one and started seeing clients. And she ended up getting a job offer that she couldn't refuse at the university, actually. And I ended up sort of taking the business on my own and first saw clients, then started doing classes, and then started writing, and then got a radio show, and then we were off and running.
Yeah, cool. And so, 40. So, when we, how old were you when you finished university?
I was 40.
You're 40 when you finished. Ah, cool.
Yeah.
And so, you've had a really interesting, really colorful, and I mean, I know how you felt, knowing nothing about business and getting one started. You're seeing the results of that today, everyone, and listening to this podcast. So bring us up to speed now then. What keeps you busy in 2019? And give the listeners of this show some direction as to where they can go to read your blog and find out about your books.
Yeah, thank you. Sure. I'm 70 now, and so I've retired from seeing clients. I did it for 25 years. I love doing it. It was wonderful. But after 25 years, it was just time to quit. And partly because I felt I worked so many aggression cases. You know, 80% of what I saw were aggression cases. About half of those were aggression to people. And I just, as I got older, I just started feeling slower and sort of less quick and less responsive, and just felt like it was time to pass the baton on to other people. So I don't see clients anymore. I retired from teaching at the university, which I also did for 25 years, which I absolutely adored. So what I'm doing now is I was doing a lot of speaking. I actually gave 45 talks in about a year's period on The Education of Will, the memoir that you mentioned. And so I'm taking a little pause. What I'm doing right now is I'm certainly keeping up my blog, which is theotherendoftheleash.com. I love writing my blog. I have this huge village, 45,000 plus people all over the world who, like me, are fascinated by our relationship with dogs and other animals, training issues, but it's sort of a pretty big, wide umbrella. So I always keep that up. I post every Monday, almost every Monday. And I'm active on Facebook and Instagram. But here's the big 90-degree turn. I had mentioned I love writing, and I mentioned when I was 12, I was writing these little one-page fiction stories. Well, that's where I'm going now. In my dotage, Ryan, now that my hair is all gray and silver, I am going back to one of my first passions and trying to write a novel. And foolishly, perhaps, not just fiction, but I'm trying to write a mystery. I love mysteries. I read them constantly. So there we are. So tomorrow morning, I will be sitting at my computer at home in my study on my little farm, working on the outline of this crazy-ass mystery I'm trying to write. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to try.
Hey, that's really exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I have no idea what's going to happen, but it's really fun playing at it right now.
Amazing. And 45,000 people.
Yeah.
Following the blog every Monday. How long have you been doing that for?
Oh, man, a long time. Man, when did that start? I could look it up. At least 15 years, I would say. 08, maybe. Well, maybe, let's see, 08, 07. I would say, I don't know, 13, 14 years or so. Yeah, it's really fun. I love it.
It's a lot of Mondays.
It's actually a lot of work, but I have so many smart readers who write the most fascinating comments. They're just, I ran into one. It was so great. I was doing a book signing. I gave a talk on Vashon Island, which is on the northwest coast of the States, off the coast of Seattle. And I was doing a talk at a book signing. And there was a line of, you know, like 45 people or something. And somebody handed me a book and said, "Hi, I'm Kat, Kat with Ranger and Finna." And I went, "Kat, she's been commenting on my blog for years, and like I feel like her friend." And there she was right in front of me. It's really very, very gratifying. I really enjoy it.
Okay. Amazing. What gives you the inspiration for your next blog piece?
Oh man, it's so easy. I thought I'd run out of ideas, and I'm sure every once in a while you're like, "Oh, you know what I'm going to write about?" It's just amazing. I mean, life just hands us this cornucopia of things, right? So, you know, I have working border collies. We have a very small sheep farm. Maggie's now a trial competitor. I just moved her up to the open, big, highest class. I have this rescued, very, very old little puppy mill dog, Tootsie, the King Charles Spaniel. There's always something interesting going on in dog training and behavior. I mean, it's really more, what do you want to not talk about as much as what do you want to talk about, right? Don't you find that there's just, you never run out of things to talk about?
I do now. I struggled for a long time.
Did you?
But I had a bit of training. And then the training was basically just like, what's happening in your life right now, Ryan?
Yeah.
That was it. That was the question. And then obviously there's answers to that. So
there you go.
Started writing about it. So that's inspiring to hear someone who's been doing it for so long, how you go about it as well, and for you to say it's easy, because I know a lot of animal trainers out there are wanting to create content.
There's a lot out there, isn't there? Yeah, there's more and more and more. And I think in general, it's wonderful. I mean, some of the videos that are out there, some of the training sites, I mean, it's fantastic. It's, you know, my website where you can go to my blog, it also, but it has a learning center, and I've posted articles I've written and, you know, content related blogs always go up there, and their videos, and it's free. And there's so much great free information. But I will say, the one thing I will say, there is nothing like hands-on experience, you know, because it's a sport. I always have said that dog training is a science, an art, and a sport. And the sport part takes a lot of practice. You know, you have people don't think about how they're moving their body when they're asking their dog to come. You know, they call their dog to come, and they don't think about the fact that they're moving forward, which is basically a message to their dog to stop, right? And you have to learn to coordinate your voice and your actions and your words. It's just not inherent. I remember years ago, I used to work with troubled adolescents, and one of the first things we were taught was sort of the classic person who says, "I love my mother," while shaking their fist and frowning. "I love my mother." It's like, so which do you listen to, right? The tone or the actual words? And so there really is a sport aspect to it. And there's so much we can learn online and reading. I mean, obviously I write books, so I want people to read them. But there's nothing like having a coach helping you and watching you and giving you feedback about how you're behaving around your dog, because most of us are pretty oblivious until we learn to think about it. Don't you think? You have to learn it like a sport almost.
It's like we need sport commentators.
Yeah.
But good sport commentators.
Well, that would be hysterical at a dog show or something, wouldn't it?
It's like, does his voice match his movement forward? I don't know.
Did you notice how he's always having problem with his left hand moving when he doesn't want his left hand to move? I think that's actually the cue for the dog. I can just see golf commentators, right? Be great. Maybe that's a new field for you, Ryan.
Sport commentating?
Sport, yes. Dog sport commentating.
Kind of reminds me of that saying, though, that there's only two things any dog trainer can agree on, and that's what the third one's
doing wrong.
I can see the potential, but I can also see the potential for it not going so well. Hey, that was a lot of fun to learn about. Thank you so much for sharing your behavior odyssey with us here at ATA. We appreciate that. Moving forward, I'd really like to discuss something you mentioned that you wanted to talk about today. And this is the human, what we're going to call, because you can unpack for us what it means, what we're going to call the human-animal relationship. Can you speak to this for us, Patricia?
Oh, yeah. How long do we have, Ryan? We have 24 hours, was it?
Sure.
Yeah, sure it is. No, yeah, no, I would love to, because that is really the topic that I feel most attracted to, that I find most interesting. And I find it interesting sort of professionally, theoretically, intellectually, and personally, emotionally, sort of the whole package. You know, it just sort of puts the whole package of my love and interest in animals together. So there's so much to it. You know, part of it is personal, you know, and part of the personal part is emotional. You know, I imagine many of your listeners are like me, and that we are just simply stupid in love with our dogs. I think, you know, Ryan, I lost one of those forever dogs. I think I can talk about it without losing it. I think it's been long enough. But Willie died of lung cancer sort of shockingly fast, horrifically, awfully. And I was gutted. I mean, he was a family member. He was a friend. He was a coworker. He was, you know, one of the reasons I said I think we love dogs so much is that they fill the role of parents in a way, or what we want our parents to be. And they give us all this unconditional love, right? But they're also like our infants in that they're nonverbal and we have to protect them and take care of them. So we have that kind of love for them. And they're our friends and they're our coworkers, you know, sort of everything. And so that whole attachment to dogs, I find to be fascinating. To me, it's a biological miracle that individuals of two very different species in many ways have formed this amazing social relationship such that some of us will risk our lives to save a member of another species, you know, in both directions, right? Many of us grieve when we lose a dog even more than we grieve when we've lost, you know, some human, just because that relationship is so complicated with humans, right? So there's that personal emotional side, but there's also the sort of cultural social side of that I find fascinating of how, you know, who are we in relation to other animals? How do we think of ourselves? And what implications does that have that as a culture, as a society, and as individuals in the way we treat them? I'm reading a wonderful book. It's not about animals. It's just about plants. It's called Braiding Sweetgrass. And it's by a Native American woman who's a Native American and a botanist. And she talks about trying to integrate Western science with a Native American perspective. And it's very much sort of where my head goes, because on the one hand, I was trained as a scientist. I want data, right? I want information. But there's also this very deep atavistic connection, I think, that we all have, whether we even know it or not, between us and the natural world. And so how our understanding of that drives a tremendous amount of decisions we make. You know, do we keep, there are people who believe keeping dogs as pets is cruel, that it's oppressive and exploitative and shouldn't, you know, it's unethical. And there are people who don't eat meat because they believe that raising sheep and then eating lamb is unethical. And how do we feel about animals and research, et cetera? And what about wildlife and trade-offs there? So it's, I mean, I could go on and on, you can tell, but it's just, there's so much in there, from personal relationships to social decisions to cultural decisions and to actions that we take as humans, as individuals, I should say, and as society. So it's really, it's everything, pretty much. That's the answer, Ryan. Human-animal relationships, everything. Here we go. Done.
So how do we take all of us, all of these ideas, all of the possible never-ending rabbit holes that this idea could take us down, thinking about this braiding sweet grass and blending Western science with indigenous knowledge and methodology, how do we bring that into our life as trainers? Is it something that we need to think about as trainers more, or is it, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think a lot of dog trainers, and they may not think about it, but I think they inherently understand that need for an integration of a sort of science-based approach to animal training, right? Like you are such a good proponent of, you know, understanding how animals learn and how to affect that, and that it's not about dominance, right? It's about understanding how animals learn and how we can use those principles in the most benevolent way to train our animals to do what we want them to do. But at the same time, there's so few animal trainers who don't have this profound emotional, if not, I will say the word, spiritual connection, you know, really deep, deep, profound psychological connection with their dogs or their horses or, you know, perhaps their cats or their birds, you know, you name it. And so I think a lot of trainers really understand the importance of integrating those things. I think what we need to do, what I would like us to do, is use the science part to help people understand, one, how to interpret what their dog is trying to tell them, because a lot of us are not trained in that dog is looking fearful, for example, you know, he's growling at you because he's terrified, right? So, you know, we can do a better job at that. We can do a better job at teaching them the science, which is not rocket science, by the way. The science of learning is not that hard, right? It's not rocket science, just math. I think neurobiology is what should be called rocket science. It's really hard. But also bringing in that sense of, and it's sort of an American, Native American sense of, we are, it's everything out there, everything alive has a kind of is a being and is a being to be respected. And every dog out there is an individual being to be understood as best as possible and respected, you know. So that's another way to sort of move against the dominance paradigm and the force paradigm and into the, what do I want to teach you? What do I want us to learn together? How do I want us to make a relationship as two individuals who are respectful of each other, right? And who want to be partners.
And is this current way of looking at things and what you're describing right now, is it coming from your ethology background? When you're working with a client or going in and looking at animal behavior, do you feel, and I want to kind of get your opinion on this and then have some further questions on this line of
okay.
thought. Do you have your ethology hat on? Do you have applied behavior analysis hat on? Do you have both hats on? Are you wearing like five hats at once,
yeah.
or do you change hats? Does that make sense?
It does. It's a great question. They're all smashed onto my head, all simultaneously at once. So imagine me with this, like, you know, massive pile of hats on my head at the same time. So when I'm seeing clients, or you know, or when I'm working with my own dog, for example. So I'm always thinking about communication, about what, you know, what can I tell? How can I read that dog? What is it about that dog's behavior that is telling me what's going on? You know, what it's about to do, perhaps what its emotional state is. You know, sometimes it matters why animals are feeling the way they are. Sometimes it doesn't matter. Frankly, we need to change the behavior. I really like knowing both. And so that's really important. You know, what was the antecedent, right? What was the environment going on that created the situation in which the dog did behavior X, right? What do I want that dog to do rather than X? What is behavior Y, right? You know, and then how can I create consequences that get behavior Y rather than behavior X? So that's always there. So the ethologist is always there. The psychologist and learning theory is always there. But the other part, the part of me who was a social worker, who worked with troubled adolescents, who minored in psychology before I had to drop out of college when I was 19 because I got sick, the part of me that loves to meditate, that lived actually on a Navajo Indian reservation for a while, so it's very connected in a way to that perspective. They're all smashed on, all those hats are smashed onto my head at the same time, pretty much. And pretty much all the time, you know, that's just sort of who I am.
And so in your words, is that how you teach others to kind of be consistently wearing all of the hats? Or is that something that comes from playing the sport for so long gets you? Or are you teaching new people, let's say, I'm going to say new people, green people, lay people, whatever you want to use it, are you kind of teaching them one to wear one hat and wear it well? Or how do you blend all of these hats together? I mean, for you and your experience, and I mean, you just said so many different things there. You got sick, you lived on an indigenous reserve or something. you've got a colorful sport background. You're walking out on the field, knowing how to do everything. But how do you teach that? How do you teach that? How do you teach wearing so many hats?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think indirectly, and I first have to say, have I been successful at it? I don't know. I don't know. I hope so to some extent. I think possibly sometimes I am. I think you don't have. I think just by being authentic and being who I am, all those things come out at the same time. So, for example, when I'm doing a seminar, I mean, I have a DVD out called Lost in Translation about all the different ways that dogs communicate and how we miscommunicate with them and sometimes communicate effectively. And so it combines, you know, when I'm talking, I'll show data from research, you know, I'll talk about this research that just showed that we can interpret dog barks, but not their expressions very well, for example. But at the same time, hopefully I'm role modeling a kind of respectful benevolence and talking in such a way that makes it really clear to people that I think we are all connected. We are all more the same than we are different. I tend to, it's very important to me, like on the blog and the other end of the leash, I don't allow snarky comments. If somebody makes a snarky comment, I will email them and say, I really want to hear what you have to say. But the tone on this blog is one of respect and an interest in open communication. And so if you want to reword what you said, then I'd be happy to post it. And people usually do, by the way, which is really cool. So I think you role model, in part, Ryan, the way you respect others and work with them. You know, I never laugh at clients. I might laugh with them, but I never laughed at them. I don't like sort of the ain't it awful and isn't that a horror. I don't get in those conversations with anybody, even after two glasses of wine, about they're bad and I hate that method. And I don't like to go there very much. I try not to. Because again, we are all in this together.
Can you unpack the words respectful benevolence a bit more? What does it look like for someone wanting to, how do you role model that for someone? Is that doing just what you just said?
Sure. Actually, here's an example. I just posted a comment on my blog. It was a post I had written years ago about prong collars, which I'm not a big fan of. And someone just wrote in, and I just posted it, but I haven't had a chance to get back to her yet, about how prong collars are great if it just wasn't for the idiots who use them incorrectly. And so I wouldn't use that word, you know? So basically, I will get back to that person and say, you know, another way to frame that is, in your opinion, prong collars can be useful only if people who haven't been taught correctly how to use them are actually using them correctly. I mean, I'm not doing a very good job of being very articulate, but basically, you can see how I'm just trying to reframe the words that are used. You know, it's so easy to be hurtful. It's so easy to use harsh words, especially in today's social media climate. But I see no purpose in it. It's divisive. And, you know, there is divisiveness in dog training. We both know that about, you know, what method is best, right? And I don't see any purpose in setting, sort of creating us and them and a this side and that side, you know. I am all for open and respectful conversations. And it's just not that hard, you know. You just need to take a break and be respectful. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. And I think it's really valuable. I'm wondering if we can unpack it more or if we've done enough. So I'm just going to repeat some takeaways from the conversation and you tell me if it inspires you or not. We're nearly reaching 100 episodes of this podcast show, and I've been very lucky in my career to meet some amazing people and have some amazing mentors. And I feel like I describe to people that I'm always wearing my applied behavior analysis hat. But I'm so interested in being able to develop the skill of wearing so many hats, which is why I'm staying on this subject and saying I'm not sure if it's going to take us anywhere. But do you have anything else to add to that? Like what are you seeing? What have you seen in our industry over 30 years and the conversation between the sister sciences and how we integrate these all to be as effective and to help as many animals as we can?
Yeah, a lot of good things and a few not so good things, basically. I mean, I think You know, there is so much integration now between, as you say, between learning theory and science and, you know, behavior analysis and companion dog training. I mean, it's wonderful. And there's so much information that was out there. When I first started, one of my goals was to increase the professionalism of dog trainers, to continue to advocate for more science in dog training. And that's just blossomed. I mean, that's just been amazing. That's been phenomenal. That the world, when I started dog training, I mean, it's not even recognizable. You know, it's just profoundly different. I actually started doing my own classes in, what was it, 1988 or 89? Because I saw these dogs for serious behavioral problems because the trainers in the classes were teaching such harsh methods that it was creating all this defensive aggression. So I'd see dogs who'd never bitten until I went to a training class, you know. So that improvement is just, it's amazing and it's wonderful and it's spreading. You know, Steve White, for example, is a policeman who now trains police dog trainers all around the world using positive reinforcement methods. Mark Hines at Kong Company is doing the same thing. And it's really starting to spread, which is really wonderful. In my sport, sheepdog handling and trialing, there's a lot less correcting and force and a lot more understanding of why the dog is doing what it's doing and how to create a situation where it can win and you can reinforce it. So that's just fantastic. The downside is, or the sort of the not so pretty picture is that, like much of the world in many other fields, training has gotten, there are aspects of it that have gotten more divisive. There is a certain amount of snarkiness and nastiness between camps. You know, the dominance or okay to use force camp versus the other sort of end of that continuum, which is 100% positive reinforcement camp. There's in my opinion, I wish there was a little bit more, more taking of a breath, you know, a little less reactivity, a little less blaming. It sort of fits the whole social media, let's anonymously or not jump on somebody and shame them or blame them. I don't see any purpose in that. And I see a lot of harm in it. So again, I think the more, and I just do this as much as I can, I'm not perfect, believe me, I'm not always benevolent, but I think the more we can role model that kind of openness and respect for others, the better. You know, I do a little bit of meditating, and one of the most valuable parts of that is to do there's a kind of a meditation which is about compassion, you know, and so you have a little litany of things you say for yourself, and then you expand that litany, you know, may I be safe and protected, and then you do it with, like, may Jim be safe and protected, and then you work your way through to people you really don't like, and you say, may this person be safe and protected, and, you know, that kind of sort of circle of compassion, I think, is very needed in this world today.
I'm thinking about all the people I could say right now, but I'm not going to. I keep going, I'll say, no, I won't do that. You're on a podcast, Ryan.
You notice I'm not saying anything either. There's a lot of people on the other end of that I could bring in that I have to work towards. There are a few people I have not yet been able to. I'm working on it, though. I'm working my way up. It's practice. It's just like dog training. You just have to practice.
Maybe you don't have to say them, but if I can guess them and then you say yes. No, I'm just joking. We won't do that. And so maybe you've already answered this. And if so, you can say, Ryan, have you been listening at all? But if you haven't, we can build on this. And maybe just final words on this part of the podcast episode then. How are we the same and how are we different from animals in general, not just dogs?
Oh, I love that question. No, I think, well, we can spend a lot of time on that question. So there's sort of the obvious part, right? In terms of our differences, I mean, you know, no other animal is doing a podcast right now, right? No other animal has invented duct tape and post-it notes, which is our society's greatest accomplishment, in my opinion. You know, so our cognitive ability, our brains have have created a species without question that's unlike any other. I mean, there's no question about it. But I think we've made a lot of mistakes over the centuries in thinking that because we're so good at thinking, right, problem solving, it meant for hundreds of years, the belief by scientists anyway, that animals couldn't do that at all. You know, that animals can't think. Animals, I mean, you know, going back to Descartes and when was Descartes? 1600, somewhere around there. I think, therefore I am. And his argument, without language, you can't think. And then if you can't have language, and therefore you can't think, and therefore you're not sentient. You have no consciousness. You know, you're just sort of basically like a clock. And so we've certainly gone far beyond that. But I'm getting so far off track. Take me back to your first question. Oh, I am. I'm just spiraling into my brain. Oh, I know. I've spiraled back again. What? How we're the same, and how we're different. So yes, we have very complicated cognitive lives. But we also have complicated emotional lives. But I argued in For the Love of a Dog, for example, and have in many talks, that our emotional life is much more like that of other mammals than it is different. And that's any mammal, basically, because all mammals have the same general hardwiring when it comes to our emotional life. It's true that the cognitive part of our brain affects the emotional part of our brain in ways that's not true with other animals, but the general basics of fear and anger and happiness a few other primal emotions are universal across mammals. I mean, that part of our brain is actually called the mammalian brain, you know, because it exists in all mammals. And the physiology is the same. The hormones, the neurohormones, just the whole way our body works, if you're a mammal, is very similar. So it's certainly true that fear might be different in us because we could maybe think about what it's going to mean in the future to us. But it doesn't mean the basic sense of how we feel when we're afraid, you know, that physical sense of being afraid. That's very similar in, you know, polar bears and people and dogs and cats and ferrets and horses. So we're different, but we're also the same. And so getting back to your question, Ryan, about relationships, I think part of why I think our relationship with dogs is so important is because dogs are, in a way, they're kind of a bridge for us to the rest of the natural world. You know, we can think of ourselves as so special. You know, we all like to be special, but being special also puts you outside of the group. And so there's a kind of loneliness in being special. And I think it's easy for us to feel disconnected with the natural world, which science tells us is really important for us to be happy and healthy. You know, more and more and more research about the impact of being outside in nature, and even just looking at a picture of a field or a pond or something, can actually change a person's emotional state. And it's like dogs are like, they're like this portal. They're like this Alice in Wonderland portal between us and the rest of the natural world. And I think they play this incredibly important role in keeping us a little grounded in that, yes, we're human, we're different, we're special, we're amazing, but we're just mammals and we're part of everything. And we're dead without oxygen and we need clean water. And, you know, without all that nature, quote, nature around us, we're not separate from it. We're just part of it. We're just one little tiny part of it. And I think it's humbling, but I also find it, there's a sense of security. There's sort of a sense of belonging in it that I think is very healthy for us.
So how's that changed for you over, not changed for you, but how do you feel our community has changed, in your opinion, over 30 years with regards to accepting we are different, but we're also the same? Do you think, and maybe it's obviously I think it would be, maybe not obvious, you tell me, different between different parts of our community, but is there some resistance to wanting to feel that we're actually the same?
Oh, of course. I mean, yeah.
As other species?
Yeah, I do. I think there is, because it is a bit daunting, you know? I'm sort of, the more we think about the sentient lives of other animals, the more the way we treat them becomes a little more complicated and a little bit of a gray area. You know, right now, I do eat meat. I eat meat very selectively on what people call a conscious carnivore. So I don't eat commercial chicken, unless I do. Like when I'm stuck and I'm traveling, I will, you know, but I generally don't. We eat our own lamb that is raised in a very humanely. I'm lucky in that I can afford to do that because it's more expensive to eat that way. But so I do eat meat, but I'm also very conscious that the sheep on my farm, because I have so few, frankly, you know, I don't have 5,000 sheep, you know, like some of the farms in, you know, on the South Island, right? Or out west, and you know, on the sheep ranches out west here in the States. So I know each one of my sheep as individuals, and I know perfectly well that they have internal lives, that they have different personalities, that they can be very fearful, they can be. And I'm stretching here. Some people will not like me saying this. I would argue to you that they can be angry. So it makes it different, you know, in that I eat their babies. And I've thought a lot, long and hard, about how I feel ethically about doing that. So I think there is resistance. And in part, I think it's because it makes life more complicated. And a lot of people don't like gray areas. They like life more black and white. I sort of like the gray. I find it fascinating. Angst producing sometimes, but fascinating. But I also think it's also partly just a lack of understanding, you know. I mean, I've had people still in this day and age argue to me that, you know, well, dogs can't experience their own emotions, you know. There's that's not possible. You know, I'm perfectly well-trained, educated people who have no concept of the neurobiology of fear and the brain and how it works. And so I think it's partly education and partly because the acknowledgement of it is a little tricky to manage.
It's an area I find really interesting to kind of see how the human has evolved. And from my own research, and tell me what you know about this, or maybe you can tell me that I'm wrong. Like we've had to continuously adjust how we define how we're different, because we keep finding out that we're not different.
Yes. Oh, yes. It's so true. And I think it's wonderful, you know, in so many ways. I mean, tool creating in parrots, you know, problem solving in how many species, you know, it used to be, you know, we were called man the toolmaker, right? Because we were the only ones who made tools. And now the Caledonian crow, are they New Zealand or Australian? I think they might. Do you have Caledonian crows?
No, they're on the New Caledonian Islands, which is the French territory.
Oh, thank you. Okay, see, I'm learning. I'm always learning something. So the New Caledonian crow, I mean, you can find it on YouTube. There's an amazing video of a crow in a lab who's given a problem to solve. There's a straight piece of metal. It's just a straight piece of metal. There's a little tiny basket with a handle on it that's inside like a glass tube. And the crow can't stick his beak in far enough to get the food and the basket out. He picks up the straight wire, holds it in his beak, bends it with his claw, creates a hook, right? You probably know this, right? And pulls the food out, right? So yeah, you are so right, is that we are learning so much more about the capabilities of other animals. And I do think it really is pushing the envelope and forcing some people, whether they like it or not, to acknowledge that, again, we may be special, but we're not as special as we thought. And I find that, I like that. It makes me feel good. Some people feel threatened by it. I love it. I like being even more connected.
Hey, looking at the time, I'm going to push on to the last two questions.
But this sure.
Been absolutely fascinating, and I'd love to keep going on that, but we're not going to. But I think it actually moves really nice into our next topic that we want to talk about, and this is communication. So, taking everything on board you've just said, what is the word when you think about your communication with other species, whether it be dog, sheep, cats, horses, whatever, cotton top, tamarins, New Caledonian crows? What does the word communication mean to you?
Oh, how long do we have? Are we doing another whole podcast here? Because that's a really interesting question. And I'm actually going to start with what I learned in ethology, that science of behavior that you and I talked about earlier, which was that you can look at communication from the perspective of the sender, right? So why is that? Why, you know, imagine a bird on a wire or a dog barking at a window. So why is the dog barking? Why is the bird leaning forward towards another bird as it comes to try to land beside it on the wire? What is the message that is being sent? You know, and it could be something very specific about some information, Or it could be about its emotional state. I'm excited, I'm aroused, I'm scared, etc. But then there's a message, which is what is actually received by the individual who is on the receiving end of that, right? And it might be different than what's actually being sent. And you can think of communication from both perspectives. It's like what's being sent, but what's actually being understood and perceived. And I think bringing that back to dog training, and circling back to some of the things we were talking about earlier, it's so easy for us to miscommunicate. You know, we're primates, right? And so we want to greet dogs by walking straight towards them, looking right at their eyes, and then reaching sort of forward, you know, like we would shake somebody's hand, like a good friendly primate would do, right? Direct forward, you know, face-to-face contact, eye contact, moving forward, right? You do that to a dog, as we all know, everybody listening, that's a threat. That's not a kind or friendly way to greet another dog, if you're a dog. And so I think a huge part of improving our communication, because I think, honestly, I think a huge amount, I'm trying to make up a number, I don't know, 90% or something of our, quote, behavior problems or disobedience problems are simply miscommunication problems. So I think a huge part of having the dog we want, having a polite dog, however we define it, you know, having a happy, friendly relationship with our dog is about understanding first how they communicate. If we're the smarter species, then we should first learn their communication. So you need to learn what it means when a horse's ears go back, you know, what it means if your cat starts swishing his tail, what it means when your dog closes its mouth and goes tense and stops moving, even if the tip of its tail is wagging, which is not friendly, as we both know. So I think that's one of the first things that I think is really critical in communication, and learning how the other species communicates, and then understanding that, and then learning how most effectively to communicate back.
So I think myself and listeners of this show could answer this question I'm about to ask you, but that's irrelevant because I want to hear it in your words. when we go to learn this skill of communicating effectively and not having problems and being in the 10% that don't have any problems at all, just joking, because we are communicating efficiently, how do we learn this? Is it from putting on the ufology hat, learning about that species and what all of their nuances mean, or is it about learning about applied behavior analysis and describing behavior operationally and what the context of that behavior is? Or is it about just playing the sport and just getting your hands dirty, getting your 10,000 hours with dogs, as Gene Donaldson might say? Or is it a combination of all of those things? Like I said, myself and the listeners of this show could potentially hypothesize what you're about to say, but yes. I want to hear it in your words. What do we do?
Oh, but I want to hear first what you think I'm going to say. That's far more fun. What am I going to say, Ryan?
All of the things, and stay short, it depends.
Ryan knows my work well. Yes, that's my answer to almost every question. But in this case, it doesn't depend. In this case, your first answer was absolutely what I would say is all three simultaneously. Because, you know, if you're doing behavior analysis and you're trying to decide what consequence, right? So what reinforcement are you going to give a dog who's doing what you want it to do when you listen to that behavior? You have to be able to read your dog, right? You have to be able to know what your dog is telling you. You know, and sometimes it might be he doesn't take the treat, so it's really obvious. But, you know, it also might be his mouth closes, or he does whale eye, or, you know, his head turns an inch to the right. So I think being a good observer and understanding ethologically sort of based perspectives and using that at the same time you understand learning theory and behavior analysis. And what was the third thing?
Playing the sport.
Oh, yeah, and the sport. So you have to know, I mean, you can't be good at reinforcing if your timing isn't good, right? I mean, one of the hardest things I think about certain kinds of animal training is getting your timing right. I mean, how many times have you like missed it, right? You're like, oh, he just offered that. I just missed it, right? That's the sport part. So yes, you are absolutely correct. All three simultaneously.
Well, thanks for sharing that in your words. Sadly, this does now bring us to the final question for this episode. Patricia, could you please now take us forward into the future? What do you really want to see happen over the next 5, 10, 15 years in the animal training world, the animal behavior world, in our community? What do you really want to see happen?
So Ryan, there's so many different ways we interact and we train that haven't been researched as well as they could be. You know, there's so much about what's going on inside of a dog that we don't understand yet that we can with more research. So one is more research. The other is continuing to spread the word about using science-based training for the average person, you know, and we can make that change, you know, and in the States anyway. I don't know what it's like in New Zealand, Ryan, but in the States, there was a very different kind of animal training until they started bringing in military dogs. During the early wars, the American military discovered the Germans had, quote, war dogs and were using dogs in the military. And we started doing the same thing because we didn't want to be behind. People actually were sending their Cocker Spaniels to the Army base. It was rather sad and pathetic. So sort of standard dog training became like Marine boot camp. And it was true for decades and decades and decades here. That's how the first classes I went to were literally like Marine boot camp. It was frankly horrific. And so we still need to work really hard to change the general cultural understanding of how best to train a dog, you know, and to get what you know, Ryan, out more and more and more to the general public. So yay on podcasts like this. I mean, it's just invaluable. The one other thing I want the word to go out more about, something that I saw constantly, my colleagues see constantly. There's even research to back it up. Michelle Wan did some great research on showing videos to people of varying degrees of experience with dogs. And the people with less experience, maybe they had one dog, a family dog, very, very bad at reading signs of fear or discomfort or stress in a dog. The more experienced people have, the better at looking at a dog and saying, that dog looks uncomfortable. That dog looks fearful. Therefore, I need to change my behavior. Therefore, I need to not punish the dog. Therefore, I need, et cetera, et cetera. And so the more we can get the word about so much of dog misbehaviors and, quote, aggression is about fear. And being able to read that in the face or the body of the dog, I think, is essential. And it's really, to me, somewhat surprising that as a species, we're not very good at it. We're not very good at reading it in dogs. And so we need to up that. And the other, and I talk about this in my memoir, The Education of Will, is understanding that all mammals can be psychologically traumatized. Some people talk about PTSD in dogs. I'm not comfortable doing that because we can't all, there's a set criteria to diagnose PTSD, and we can't know that dogs sort of check all the boxes. We can't ask them if they have nightmares or flashbacks. But there's no question that dogs can be psychologically traumatized. And so understanding that certain training methods truly can traumatize a dog, and psychological trauma can change the brain, the way the brain behaves, the physiology of an animal, very much not to that animal's advantage, and can lead to long-term behavioral problems, not to mention suffering for the dog. So the more we can get the word out that, not exactly like us, but that dogs can be very frightened and very fearful and act defensively, and they also can be psychologically traumatized such that they have permanent damage to the function of their brain. And that's true, as I was saying earlier, of all mammals. So that's my hope, is that we can keep moving more and more and more in that direction.
More research, more spreading of information, and recognizing and continuing conversations and spreading information about trauma.
So that's your job, Ryan. You're young. Go for it. You got 40 years on me. You got 40 more years.
We call here at ATA each small thing we do to contribute towards that ripples. So these are the ripples for this week as you're the center of this show to achieve Patricia McConnell's vision moving forward. And we encourage you all to take the ripples from this episode and to, as Patricia has asked us, continue to spread those ripples. And thank you in advance, everyone who's listening who does that. Thank you. Hey, I know we've said it at the start of the episode, Patricia, but just another opportunity for you now to tell the listeners of the show, if they wanted to find out more about you, read your blog, where can they go to do all of that?
Oh, thanks for asking, Ryan. The easiest thing to do is just Google my name, Patricia McConnell, and go to my website, where you can go to my blog through that. It's The Other End of the Leash, but there's also, you can find more information about my books and DVDs, and then there's that Learning Center. And I'm taking a little speaking sabbatical, as I mentioned. I'm working on writing, but I will jump back into the speaking circuit again because I do love doing it. So you can sort of stay attuned to what's going on, and hopefully it will be of value to you.
Wonderful. And if you don't know what Google is or don't know how to use it,
Google it.
We will, yeah, go to Bing and search Google. We'll link to all of this in the show notes as well. Hey, Patricia, this has been so much fun from myself and on behalf of everyone listening to the show today. We really appreciate you taking the time to come and hang out with us here at Animal Training Academy. It's really appreciated. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Absolutely.
And everyone listening out there as well, we really appreciate you tuning in. If you have enjoyed this episode and you are interested in carrying on the conversation, as Patricia has asked us to do, about working with our animals in the most positive, funnish, choice-rich ways, and as mentioned at the start of the episode, the ATA community is waiting for you. Head on over to the Animal Training Academy website. It's pretty basic. You can Google it if you want. Otherwise, it's www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There is something there for absolutely everyone. And we're looking forward to having you join our tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.